DW Deutsche Welle. World Link.
Hello and welcome to DW's World Link, bringing you the personal stories behind the news headlines. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Gabriel Borut. On this week's show, right in the heart of the holiday season, terror strikes Berlin at a Christmas market. We take to the streets of the German capital to see if Christmas has been killed, like many have said, in the wake of the violence. And we're also going to talk to an expert about what this attack could mean for Chancellor Angela Merkel's political future.
If it is proven that this was an asylum seeker who came to Germany, then she's in dire straits. And I would not rule out, if there are two or three more of these cases, that she will not run in the autumn elections of next year. It is that serious.
All that and much more coming up on this special Christmas edition of WorldLink. You're listening to DW's WorldLink. I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn, Germany.
Immer mehr Rettungskräfte treffen ein.
The attack could hardly have been more symbolic. 1 week before Christmas, a truck rams into a Christmas market in the heart of Berlin, killing 12 people and injuring dozens of others. The capital and with it the country was shattered and shocked. Following the violence, the authorities have tracked down a number of suspects and have narrowed their search to a man of Tunisian origin, an asylum seeker who was set to be deported. At this point, how does the city of Berlin move on? With the threat still high, should people stay indoors and avoid public places, most of all, Christmas markets? DW's Theresa Krinninger, a Berlin resident, went through her city looking for answers.
I'm in the Berlin subway, the U-Bahn. Despite the uneasy feeling on the day after the truck attack, I'm out to get a feel of Berlin city life after the terrible event, but also observing myself and my own feelings of fear. Am I shocked? Am I feeling insecure? Do I change my lifestyle? I'm not sure yet. Inside the train, I look at the faces around me, trying to detect people's emotions, but I don't see any. But as I get closer to Breitscheidplatz, the scene of the attack, it's clear what's on everyone's mind. Christmas markets. To be honest, I'm tired of Christmas markets. For years, I worked at a stand selling leather purses. So I've had my fill and have avoided Christmas markets ever since. But the question now is whether we should avoid these places because of the danger. And what about concerts, festivals, and all that fun stuff? I meet Charlotte and Iris. They came back here to lay down flowers.
Ja, wir waren gestern da. Wir sind da vorne gestanden, wo der rein.
Yeah, we were there yesterday. We were just about to enter the Christmas market where the truck plowed into. But my friend said her feet hurt and she wanted to sit down. So we went to the sausage stand over there, and right when we were ordering, we heard the big bang. Right after that, police cars and ambulances arrived. We went back there and saw the truck and bodies lying underneath.
Despite seeing the attack firsthand, they say they would never avoid Christmas markets. Germans and tourists love Christmas markets. I walk around and look at the destroyed stalls. I thought coming here would help me realize that people actually died here, but it doesn't. Maybe that's because all the police cars and journalists running around. There are cameras everywhere. But what I find more disturbing are the many bystanders who are taking pictures and videos, including selfies. Over on the other side of the scene, I see two young women at a sausage stand behind the barrier tape, drinking Glühwein. One of them is Anastasia from Russia. She came to visit Berlin with her friend, but all they found is closed Christmas markets.
I wanted to come here with my friend. When I heard about what happened, I thought I was lucky that I wasn't at the wrong place at the wrong time. But it's strange to be here, and the atmosphere is different as well.
I agree. The atmosphere is weird. And it gets even weirder when a few people put up posters showing Angela Merkel behind bars.
Reiner Populismus, nichts anderes.
It doesn't take long until emotions stir up and journalists arrive. We have just heard that a 23-year-old Pakistani refugee is suspected of having been the driver of the truck. This is Marcel. He's interrupting the speaker's paroles about how the attacks in Germany are Merkel's fault.
It was simply disrespectful and I wanted to intervene. I find it outrageous and morally reprehensible to use this place the way they do.
Marcel admits that he came here as a disaster tourist. I ask myself if I'm doing the same. I walk away thinking about how refugees in Berlin must feel now. I also think about the special police squad that raided Berlin's biggest refugee accommodation earlier that day in order to find links to the attack. About 900 refugees live there. At the entrance of the camp, I don't get past security and I'm not allowed to talk to refugees. But outside, I meet Gabriel, a German teacher who works in the camp.
When I woke up, I saw that they had stormed the place. I thought about my students from Eritrea. The way Berlin authorities are reacting is a form of intimidation. They want to show that they're doing something, but the scapegoats are the people who live here.
This is how far our conversation gets, until a security guard shoos us away from the compound. No media allowed, he says. On my way back to the subway, I walk past a queue of newly arrived refugees. It's dark, cold, and gloomy.
Life is returning to normal at Breitscheidplatz, and traffic is flowing smoothly again. Police have reopened the square 2 days
ago. One day later, I step out of the subway at Berlin Stadtmitte and into a completely different world. Fancy cars, expensive shops, and around the corner, there's one of Berlin's most beautiful Christmas markets and a tourist hotspot. It's also the one where I used to work. These two tourists from London also came to the market. They say they are used to living with the constant terror threat at home. But despite that, the truck attack shook them as well.
We left half an hour before it happened.
So if we'd stayed there half an hour
we were gonna go back to get another crepe and have another drink. At the place that literally got hit, so
it was just fate. It's so scary to think it could have been us.
Wow.
Yeah. So we're still here. We're still back here. You still want to
enjoy your time in Berlin.
Otherwise, they win, don't they? I know it's out of respect, but otherwise
they've got what they wanted.
They've got what they wanted.
They scared everyone off.
I don't know whether it's a terrorist attack or not, but if it is, and they got what they wanted, didn't they? They don't want people to have fun, and that's what's happened, isn't it?
Maybe that is also why I am not in shock. Maybe in my mind I came to terms with it, to live with the threat and to do business as usual. In German social media it looks different. Here the debate is clearly divided between pledging unity among Berliners with hashtags like Ich bin ein Berliner or Pray for Berlin. And on the other, right-wing comments are going viral, blaming Islam and asylum seekers for the attack. At this point, police have come up with a new suspect, a man from Tunisia who was up for deportation from Germany. Back at the Christmas market, it's really quiet. Only a few people came to enjoy Christmas music, a sausage and a Glühwein.
I feel a bit uneasy, but such a thing can happen anywhere, and I'm aware of the risk because of what has happened in the recent past.
Says Dana at the stall selling roasted almonds.
But it can happen anywhere, at the airport, when I go shopping, or at the Christmas market. It is about living with the fear and being cautious.
On Facebook, Berliners mobilized to go to the Christmas market at Gendarmenmarkt again, despite the attack. We are not afraid, and we will refuse to cower or restrict our actions because of fear, is their claim. Not many followed their call. And personally, I wouldn't either. I had to force myself to go there, not because of fear, but rather because of my Christmas market phobia.
Many thanks to Theresa Krinninger for that report from Berlin. It didn't take long for reactions to start pouring in after Monday's attack. From world leaders to people on the street in Germany and abroad, solidarity was the main message. But there were others too. One of the most shocking came from a member of the Alternative for Germany on the very night of the attack, when no solid information was out regarding the identity of the perpetrator. Quote, "These are Merkel's victims," wrote Markus Pretzel on Twitter in an ostensible bid to turn the tragedy into politics. At this point, it is still too soon to say whether a registered asylum seeker was responsible for the violence. But if that is indeed the case, as it does look now, the reality is that Chancellor Merkel may encounter problems. I spoke to German political expert Heinz Schulte about that and other possible consequences of the attack.
However cynical it sounds, Berlin is now part of the group of major cities that have suffered similar attacks. Think of a similar attack by a truck in Caen. Think of Paris. Think of London, earlier explosions there in the city in a different context. So the argument over here is it was bound to happen. And it is, of course, sad that it happened now, but nobody's really surprised by it. And that it happened before Christmas clearly showed that those perpetrators had a clear intention.
Those other cities you mentioned, Nice, London, the authorities in those particular countries have taken measures to prevent these attacks. Has Germany taken enough measures at this point to prevent such attacks? What's your assessment there?
You can always learn from these events and have to do something afterwards. But look at Caen, where it happened, where a truck drove into a crowd. So I think there were definitely policemen around. But how do you stop a 50-ton truck that runs through? I mean, not even a machine gun can stop that. So from that point of view, it seems to me this is a new quality. And now you can put all kinds of barriers in. But what happens if, God forbids, these attacks then happens outside the barriers where people crowd to get in? So at the end of the day, there's very little to stop it. But that shouldn't sound desperate. What it means is, like London and Paris have shown, we will not be defeated by these people. And I think the idea in Germany was that obviously we stopped the Christmas markets for one day. But thereafter, there was unanimous consensus in Germany that we have to continue with those markets because otherwise we would give in to the terrorists.
When it comes to the inability to prevent these attacks and the symbolism that you alluded to before, Christmas, sort of the heart of the German holiday tradition, has Christmas changed now in Germany for good? I mean, there are people saying that Germany will change forever. Our editor-in-chief, Alexander Kudashev, said, this is it. Germany is bound to change. What do you think? Is Christmas now over as we knew it?
Well, it will change, but don't forget, the Western world has changed since 9/11. And therefore, you could argue whether it is not a whole Western concept. Can we change our way of life? And the answer is clearly no, we can't and we won't. So we have to take more precautions. We have to assume that that can happen. We have to have more police, more precautionary measures, all of that. But we cannot stop having Christmas fairs. We cannot stop having carnival. I remember that in a couple of months' time, we have carnival in the streets of Cologne. There will be 1.4 million people lining the streets. So what are we going to do? Stop it? Of course not. So on the one hand, you have to live with it. But it isn't inevitable. We have to fight the roots of terrorism. We have to probably do more together as Europeans and Western world. And then we have to be defiant. I mean, like London in the Blitz, keep calm and carry on. It might sound cynical, but that's the only way we can do it.
We have to wait for the hard evidence to come in on who was responsible. I mean, ISIS has claimed responsibility. We don't know exactly who the perpetrator is. If it does end up being an asylum seeker who came to Germany in seek of help, what is that going to mean for Angela Merkel, who has pronounced this open-door policy to the world?
If it is proven that this was an asylum seeker who came to Germany and who was either registered or who came during the 2015 wave where people were literally waved through, and Merkel said they're all welcomed and we have to deal with it. If that is proven, then she's in dire straits, because one or more of these kinds of scenarios with people who are already inside Germany, not those who've come in clandestinely to do this sort of thing and we were unable to stop them, but if they had come in on the refugee asylum ticket, then she is in trouble. And I would not rule out, if there are two or three more of these cases, that she will not run in the autumn elections of next year. It is that serious.
When Merkel was at the Breitscheidplatz where the attack happened, she laid a white rose down. And when she was doing that, there was a sign above her in German. It said, "Warum?" with a question mark. That's why. The confusion and just the incomprehensibility of these attacks, can you surmise why these people are doing this here in Germany? Germany's not involved in missions abroad, military missions like France and other nations. Why do you think these people are doing this here?
Well, if you look at it from the other side, from the side of the terrorists, they would argue Germany is involved. Don't forget, Germany is arming the Kurds. So German arms for the Kurds. Germany is part of the Western world, which is the enemy as far as these people see it. So from that point of view, again, the big surprise had been that Germany had not been hit earlier. Now Germany is in the same fold as France and Britain in Europe, and if you wish, the United States since 9/11. So from that point of view, the Germans have to get used to the fact that that is a part of life. But again, not in a way that you resign yourself to the fact to say it's inevitable, but that you understand that something has to be done about it. And if a free society responds to the terrorists in a sense that it plays to their agenda, then you have lost. And therefore, the German way of life, the French way of life, all that has to be preserved with heightened security. But preserved it must.
Many thanks to German political expert Heinz Schulte speaking to me in Bonn. On my way to work this morning, I was struck by the cover of the Bild Zeitung, which is Germany's most widely read newspaper. The word Angst, A-N-G-S-T, was spread across the entire page. That word means fear. It's hard to quantify fear, but suffice it to say there's a lot in the air here in Germany these days. Frank Ferrady is one of Germany's most astute sociologists of fear, and I asked him how this attack might affect the German psyche right now.
Well, I think that societies like Germany and other Western societies, when they have these kinds of attacks, are particularly fearful because of the random quality. One of the important aspects of this kind of a threat is that it's not focused on a particular individual or on a particular target. The message that it sends out, the message is more important than the actual number of people killed. The message it sends out is that anybody is a potential target. That's what random violence does like this. And I think that, when people know that you're randomly targeted, intentionally and randomly targeted, that very often has a short-term effect where for a short period of time, people feel fairly anxious and insecure. Therefore, I'm not surprised by the German reaction. It's not any different than most other Western societies. I think there's one additional thing about Germany, which is the threat is coupled with a powerful sense of cultural insecurity, the sense that what have we done? We got people in our midst who are potentially are our enemies, who hate us. And I think that gives it a more difficult sort of dimension, because the enemy is no longer out there. The enemy is within.
The sickening paradox, potentially, of what has happened or what's going on right now is that these people, if it indeed turns out that it was a refugee or someone seeking asylum that committed this heinous act of violence, Germany opened their doors to these people, and now these people are perpetrating violence against, the hand that sort of fed them. Do you think rage can sort of act together with fear and sort of intensify each other sort of mutually?
I think so. I think it's too early for that yet. I mean, I was talking to a colleague about this the other day, and he's a psychologist, and he basically said, Frank, at some point, these attacks are going to unleash some kind of more, you know, powerful backlash or powerful reaction. And I think that's true. There is a point at which people are just, you know, going to get so fed up that something will occur. But I think, from what I understand about the German situation, that this is still fairly limited, surprisingly limited. And although some people are trying to provoke, you know, kind of a reaction and kind of make fairly unhelpful remarks or remarks that are just going to fuel the passions, I don't think that at this particular moment in time that's going to kick in. I think at the moment you have this kind of combination of numbness. You don't know, you know, you feel numb, culturally insecure, and a little bit scared.
The response in Germany, in Berlin in particular, wasn't just fear that people say that they're going to, you know, lock their doors and stay inside. Yeah. They went out. There was a day where the Christmas markets were closed. And then the next day, as we heard in a report before, people went out to sort of show that they're not going to let the terrorists win. How do you assess that response?
Well, that's a very positive response. I mean, that's more or less what happened in London after the July 2005 bombings. That's more or less what happened after the Bataclan shooting. People went out, or in Brussels, they had parties. So very often, when people feel that they've been trampled upon and, you know, really violated, there's this positive aspiration to display your resilience. And I think that's what it demonstrated. That was a message that said, look, we're fighting back. We're not going to take this, and we're not going to change the world that we live in just because you're terrorizing us. That's what's got to be normalized rather than the more passive, fatalistic fear response.
Could this make the German society stronger?
It can. I mean, you have to remember that history shows that whenever people are under attack, it does create a sense of solidarity. And that's how communities have been forged in the past. So there is always that possibility. But that requires a common narrative about what's happening. At the moment, Germany is a little bit too divided for that to occur. People have different versions of events as to how you deal with the situation. And I think Germany is going through a period of cultural uncertainty about what it means to be a German and who we are. And I think for that reason, the kind of solidarity that's created tends to be momentary rather than durable. But that can occur, you know, sort of, there's no reason why it shouldn't occur, because people have this capacity to bounce back and understand that they've got to take responsibility. This is not something that police and security officials can contain and deal with. And that's the message that one needs to send to people in Germany, that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the safety and security of society and community depends on what people in those communities do.
Professor Ferretti, as someone with a deep knowledge of the brain with regard to sort of societal dynamics, what would you say to someone who says now that Christmas will never be the same, or that Christmas has been ruined forever? What would you say to that person?
Well, I would say, you know, is to take a reality check, take a deep breath. There have been some very bad events at Christmas time in the past. You know, we can now, you know, we have a few days left before Christmas hits us, and we should just enjoy it as much as possible, and show that we're alive, you know, the spirit lives on, and we're going to celebrate and, you know, make our young people, particularly children, happy, rather than, you know, kind of focusing on the bad things that have occurred. We should focus on the positives.
Christmas will indeed carry on in Germany. You heard it here from Theresa Krenninger, Heinz Schulte, and also Frank Ferretti there, professor of sociology at the University of Kent. And this special Christmas edition of WorldLink will also carry on with me, Gabriel Borud, in Bonn, Germany. Please stay tuned.
Frankie Sinatra. Frank Sinatra. Frankie, me boy, don't know. You have a perfect voice to sing calypso. What did they say? Frankie Sinatra. Frank Sinatra. Frankie, me boy, don't know. You have a perfect voice to sing calypso. What did they say? Frankie Sinatra. Frank Sinatra. Frankie, me boy, don't know. You have a perfect voice to sing calypso. What did they say? Frankie Sinatra. Sinatra, Frankie, me boy, don't know. You have a perfect voice to sing calypso. What did they say? Frankie, me boy, don't know. You have a perfect voice to sing calypso.
Office rocker, he's office rocker. Please, Mr. Officer, I only had some vodka, little marijuana, just a few biker, and only reverse circle my head while I'm driving. Play a registration. I'll
You're listening to DW's World Link. I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn, Germany. We've heard extensively about how Christmas has been shaken by violence in the German capital. Now we're going to go back 100 years and visit the same topic. In December 1916, we know now that this was the halfway point in the First World War. Hundreds of thousands on all sides had already died, and irreparable scars left on communities across the world. But what was the holiday season back then, in the face of unending violence and war? To find that out, our correspondent Ashley Byrne has been looking through diaries and letters penned around Christmas time exactly 100 years ago.
Are we down a harvested? No!
December 1916, and for millions of people around the world, they're facing a third Christmas separated from their loved ones as war continues to rage between Britain's empire as it was then, France and their allies, Italy, Japan and Russia, and the Central Powers of Germany, Austria and Turkey. But it didn't stop people feeling hopeful that peace could be around the corner, and businesses around the world were full of optimistic Christmas marketing. Here's an advert for fountain pens in the UK.
The last Christmas of the war will see an increased demand for Swan fountain pens. The powerful interest of the last phase will enter into the letters from the front. Those with friends out there will want more of these historic letters, and they will want them in ink for clearness and permanency.
Letter writing was all the rage in 1916. It was the Twitter and Facebook of the period. And those not able to send letters home to their loved ones would record their thoughts in diary form instead. In Latvia, Elise Tess and her family had been forced to flee the front lines of the Eastern Front. She wrote this in her diary.
Third day of Christmas, 1916. And also the third Christmas full of horrors and dangers. We cannot sing peace on earth and goodwill towards men. The war is taking on an even more ominous outlook. It must be hard for the soldiers far away from their families in the cold and frost. And the longing. Our celebrations were beautiful. A bright, full Christmas tree. Warm rooms, a full table. Also, peace and health. On the first feast day, we had guests. On the second, we headed off in the snow. Trutine had learned many nice songs, which she recited so well that it was a joy to listen.
Soldiers, sailors and airmen and women found themselves scattered across the globe in December 1916. Australian Fred Garrett of the Anzac Mounted Division was in Egypt at the time, and just 2 days before Christmas, about to fight in the Battle of Magdaba.
23rd of December 1916. At about 5:30 a.m, the division formed up. Each brigade in column of route and the brigade abreast. The 3rd Brigade on our left, New Zealanders on our right, an Imperial Camel Corps to the right of them. Several of our planes came out and we could hear them dropping bombs on the Turks' position. We heard heavy firing yesterday afternoon back in camp, and I now hear that our airmen dropped 90 bombs the day before. Then we moved off, the planes coming down close and giving us a cheer. Presently, we got the order to advance, and we went at a good canter for nearly a mile across a big plain towards the Turks. But we found that the Wadi developed big fissures and ravines on our left flank, and it looked to me as if we were going into a trap and would be wiped out any minute by their machine guns and artillery.
Meanwhile, on the Western Front, a curious rumour had started spreading, which claimed that some of the old hard fighting divisions in the British Army were to be sent for the winter somewhere for an honourable rest, the King's Rest, as it was known. One of those given false hope at the time was schoolmaster turned soldier, 2nd Lieutenant John Phillips Kingdon of the Royal Bedfordshire Regiment, 1st Battalion. Age 35 in December 1916. For him, Christmas was business as usual.
24th December 1916. Battalion relieved 16th Royal Warwickshire Regiment in Quinchy Wright, Brickstacks. Trenches near firing line in an awful state. Edgware Road trench in particular being almost impassable. Christmas bombardment lasting 3 days commenced when relief was complete. One Lewis gun team of Warwick's could not be relieved till about 4 p.m. owing to their being cut off by fallen in trench. Constant trench mortar firing by both sides.
It wasn't until December the 30th that the battalion were finally able to enjoy a belated Christmas dinner. In Christmas 1914, British and German troops had famously laid down their arms and engaged in a truce. They'd exchanged gifts, sang carols and played football. This had been frowned upon by senior military figures on all sides, and it's widely believed that a truce never happened again. But a letter from 23-year-old Canadian soldier Ronald McKinnon to his sister Jeannie back home reveals a rather different story.
France, December the 30th, 1916. Dearest sister, here we are again. As the song says, I had quite a good Christmas, considering I was in the front lines. Christmas Eve was pretty stiff. Sentry, go up to the hips in mud, of course. I had long rubber boots or waders. We had a truce on Christmas Day, and our German friends were quite friendly. They came over to see us and we traded bully beef for cigars. Christmas tree bomb, which means very good.
Just 3.5 months after he wrote that letter to his sister, Private McKinnon was killed during the Battle of Vimy Ridge. Well, whilst the Canadians and Germans were putting differences aside for Christmas 1916 in at least one part of the Western Front, on board the HMS Roxburgh over in Jamaica, 27-year-old second sick berth steward Harry Tottle was having quite a different experience.
23rd December 1916. Men selling confetti were doing a great trade, and soon a confetti battle was in progress. I received a good night and at the same time a big handful of confetti right in the face. It came so unexpectedly, all I could do was to stand and laugh. Darn stuff found its way in my pockets. Ears, down inside my shirt. I had another dose just afterwards and returning to the pier, this time from a native boy, who threw the confetti and wished me a happy Christmas at the same time.
Well, while Harry was enjoying a Caribbean Christmas in 1916, in England, Flying Officer Edward Pack's Christmas was being marred by a different kind of war-related tragedy.
December 20th, 1916. A lovely day for a change. Simpson, a test pilot for Vickers Armstrong, who had a shed at the other end of our aerodrome, killed himself testing one of their aircraft. We stopped flying as a mark of respect, although this was no longer done with service pilots and pupils. December 23rd, Simpson's funeral. Go up to London and do some shopping, meet Bay. Go home and bed early. December 25th, 1916. Play bridge in morning. See to the men's dinners, have a great lunch party. Go up to London with Swart, the CO, and Black Chapman. Have dinner at Swart's house, sleep at Charing Cross Hotel.
As the year came to a close, no one could know how long the war would last or what horrors lie ahead. But one thing present in all the correspondence I've read, whether diaries, letters or stories of both sides coming together to celebrate Yuletide, is that sheer determination that hope should prevail over fear and pessimism. Let's leave the last word to Sailor Harry Tottle as he wrote to his loved ones exactly 100 years ago.
Here's wishing you all, relations and friends, the happiest of Christmas tides, if it can be so with those who are dear to you all, away from home, and so as not able to keep you happy by their presence. We must hope that God will spare us to meet the next Christmas tide, and just be happy and content with our present surroundings. So passes Christmas 1916. May the next bring us together.
And that feature was produced with the kind permission of Gordon McKinnon, Jim Tothill, Joe Edkins, Antra Kelmans, and Steve Fuller of the Bedford Regiment. The diaries and letters were brought to life by actors Christopher Strawley, Ian Macnis, Jim Thrower, Alex Olivier, and Matthew Nation. Back to the present day, we're going to go to Ottawa, Canada now, and the story of a person who is making sure the homeless in his city have food on their plates this Christmas. Chef Rick Watson will be preparing a feast set to feed 2,500 people at the Ottawa Mission. So what goes into making a meal like that, and why does Chef Rick do this? Shan Griffiths has the story.
An hour before dinner, all the tables in the Ottawa Mission's dining room have been laid with Christmas-colored linens capped off by bright red poinsettias. It feels like someone's home, which is exactly the kind of welcome Chef Rick wants for today's special guests.
They wouldn't have anywhere to go if we didn't have this for them. We make sure there's like a tablecloth on the table and there's flowers in the middle of the table. So we want it to look like, I always say, like grandma's house. They just need our help.
The kitchen is full of energy and Christmas music as dozens of cooks and volunteers get everything ready for the mission's big Christmas dinner. While Chef Rick insists on everything being fresh, this didn't all happen overnight. He's been planning this menu for 7 weeks, and it's pretty ambitious.
For Christmas, we're having oven roast turkey, tortiere, giblet gravy, savory stuffing, glazed baby carrots, green beans almondine, and 3,000 donated cupcakes will arrive.
That's 1,000 kilograms of turkey, 300 liters of gravy, 300 kilos of mashed potatoes, 200 kilograms of tortillas or meat pies, and 3,000 cupcakes. No prison slop will be served here while Chef Rick is at the helm. In 2014, he beat out all the best chefs in Ottawa to take the coveted Chef of the Year prize. His secret lies in going one better than home cooking.
I'd like to look at it what I would want to eat myself. We are so far from a soup kitchen. Here, the food is better than what's on my table at home sometimes. It's just unbelievably good.
He's very mindful of the nutritional needs of this vulnerable demographic.
They're not normally eating well. And the food banks, you know, they try their hardest, but they don't always provide fresh produce, not so much healthy. We need to make sure these guys have a healthy meal. We want comfort food as well, you know, like mashed potatoes and things that will fill them up and, you know, keep them warm.
Like any good chef, he knows how to make the most of a tight budget. But he's also grateful for generous donations from the community. Those 100 turkeys are all donated and all grade A. Rick wants to make sure it's nothing but the best for his guest today because he knows what it's like himself to hit upon hard times.
There was a time in my life, I was 14 years old. My mother has some mental illness, and my father, he died at a fairly young age. So it was just a really rough go in my life. I was on the street and messed up on drugs and alcohol, and I just didn't see any hope. And I managed to get a job at Queen's University, Banry Hall, the women's residence, in the dish room. And I was 14, and there was a guy there that just saw some potential in me, and he just kind of took me under his wing, and he just told me there's a better life, you know, and giving me some confidence. It all turned out wonderful. That would have been 40 years ago.
His mentor encouraged him to go to college to get a chef's training, which he did. He ended up with a good job, a nice house, and a good life. But he says something was missing.
So I came to the mission, and I volunteered, and I never left. I left a job that was paying much more, and I took a cook's job here, and then very quickly I moved up to manager of food services.
And though he runs a tight ship full of dedicated cooks and volunteers, it seems there's always room for humor.
I have one rule in life, I do what chefs
say. Okay, it's like a ship. Jake, one of the cooks in the kitchen, pauses to talk turkey and shares secrets on how to cook for thousands.
What we do is, in advance of Christmas, we debone the turkeys and we separate the white and the dark, roast them both, slice them, then we reserve them in these pans, cover them with a bit of turkey stock that we've reserved, cook them, and then serve them to the people. But yeah, this is actually the only way to serve this quantity of turkey to people. This is probably about 40 portions right here.
Okay, and how many trays like that do you have in the back?
I'd say we probably have at least 200.
A few feet away, Chloe, a volunteer, is peeling eggs to make salad.
Honestly, there's often a misconception about the homeless. Like, people, when they come downtown, they feel afraid of them and all that. Like, there's nothing to be afraid of. These people have hit rock bottom, and they're just looking for a hand on. They're very kind. They mean you no harm.
Behind her, another volunteer is using a kitchen tool resembling a garden rake to stir 300 liters of steaming, delicious-smelling homemade gravy in an enormous pot. Down the line is Rory on stuffing duty. He'll be spending the rest of the day preparing 30 trays of stuffing fit for 3,000 of Ottawa's hungriest.
I love making stuff in them. Yes, you got bacon, carrots, celery, onion. We like to make everything in-house here.
And a few feet away, Simon Peter's taking huge pride and care today in his job as chief potato masher. He's going to spend the rest of today turning 20 bags of potatoes into scrumptious mash with a little help.
This is a special machine for mashed potatoes. We put in garlic, white pepper, and we put in some salt. And afterwards, we add in margarine and some milk.
And downstairs in the basement are the cupcake crew. Katrina, Kim, and Adam are unloading trayfuls of beautifully decorated cupcakes onto paper plates for dessert. They've been donated by members of the community and local bakeries.
These are all these boxes are full.
This is like a cupcake mountain.
Yes, it is.
Dinner is nearly ready to be served. It's time for a quick status update from Chef Rick.
Things are great. Everyone's in a great mood, and we're ready to rock and roll here.
A dozen volunteers standing behind the counter swing into action and begin serving. Everyone's spirits are high. In the mission's dining room, guests eagerly tuck into the meal prepared by Chef Rick and his crew.
It tastes good.
Yeah. You got a smile on your face.
Got their trip out.
I'm grateful for being here because a lot of times people forget about you when you cross the line and your own fault, but still grateful that people are here doing things for you. But I lost everything. So now I'm coming back. I'm trying to come back.
For Chef Rick, the day has been another resounding Christmas success.
It's a 10 out of 10. Everyone's happy. The volunteers are happy. There's just a magic in the air. I walk through the dining room and everyone says thank you very much, and they're appreciative, and I'm so pleased.
This Christmas, you can forget about pairing wine with your turkey. Several Michelin star restaurants have begun pairing non-alcoholic drinks, including fruit juices, with their award-winning dishes. And a German company, Van Namen, has found a fondness among foodies for single variety juices from old regional assortments of fruits. What kinds? Nick Martin found out all about it at a factory in the tiny German town of Hamingen.
Apples. They are coming through here in this tank, and then after a certain while, it's brought into this press.
Peter Van Namen's great-grandfather started this small fruit juicing company in 1917, selling into local shops and direct to the public.
Not a usual press, it's a wine press, where usually grapes are produced.
In recent years, the company has seen a lot of interest across Germany and elsewhere in Europe for its unusual flavors of apple and other fruit varieties. And in the weeks before Christmas, production is really ramped up.
We do cloudy apple juice, we don't do clear apple juice, because in the cloudy apple juice, there's more parts of the apple in the juice, so it's first more healthy, second more intense in the aroma as well.
There are more than 200 varieties of apple in the Lower Rhine region of Germany alone, each with their own distinct taste, but only a handful make it to the supermarket shelves. Taking a long-term view, contrary to most large-scale producers, Van Namen makes deals with farmers to grow these unusual varieties, even though the trees won't reach their full harvesting potential for another 30 or so years.
We always say, please let the apple hang on the tree as long as possible, because the tree is the best to really take the decision if the apple is ripe or not ripe. So the moment when the apple is ripe and the tree lets the apple fall from the tree, that's basically the moment where you have to take the apples from there, because then it's really ripe. Then you have a higher fruitiness in there, and the higher fruitiness brings much more aroma to the apple and then to the apple juice as well.
Peter says more than exponential growth and huge profits, small producers like him are keen to learn by experimenting.
I personally have worked in the wine business before, and in the wine business you have as well single varietal Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Riesling, and different varieties. So I thought, if you can do this with wine, why you can do it with juices basically as well. So we found some very old varieties from our area, and we were quite overwhelmed to see that it's really something special, that it tastes really different than the mixture of apple juices. And then it was a lot of mouth-to-mouth propaganda.
And while Van Naumann's 17 different types of apple juice sell well, it's the company's passion for unusual fruit flavours which is paying off the most, especially over the festive period.
Our biggest selling product is rhubarb. If somebody would have told me 10 years ago that rhubarb would be most interesting for us, I would have said, no, never, 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 ever. But people in Germany, they mix their juices a lot of times with sparkling water. It's called Schorle then. In 2005, somebody started to produce not just apple Schorle, he mixed himself rhubarb Schorle as well. So now it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Although many people overindulge on alcohol over Christmas and the New Year, more and more restaurants are food pairing fruit juices and nectars due to a growing demand for non-alcoholic drinks. Peter has taken this resemblance with wine a stage further by giving his juices a vintage.
At the beginning, people were laughing at me, but by now there are others who do this as well. And we have made tastings as well with three different years of a special variety of apple. You can definitely taste the difference.
Like wine tasting, you know, mm-hmm. So it's the same thing. You start with the white wines.
Wine connoisseur Piero Cini hosts a video blog giving his recommendations. Having travelled to many wine regions of the world, he's now as passionate about single variety soft drinks.
I mean, I love rhubarb. I appreciate it in the kitchen. I use it often to make a cake. The rhubarb is made from the variety Frambozen and Sutton, which add complexity and acidity to this nectar. Yeah, this okay. Is really fresh. This is 100% rhubarb. It's really intense, really fragrant.
And it's not overpowering at all, because rhubarb is quite a strong taste.
Super intense, yeah.
Yeah, when you have it in a dessert.
Absolutely. And what I like really about rhubarb is that this is perfect to match with sparkling water.
Then there's the white peach.
This is super to match with Franciacorta, Champagne or Prosecco. Create a really nice Bellini. Super, huh?
It is. It's really nice.
It has really elegant sweetness. The white peach, when it's during the harvest time, they make 3-4 picking sessions. They are only the ripest fruit gets picked.
Okay, so this is the bottling, yeah?
This is the bottling. You see there are some machines around here, like the cleaning machine of the bottles, which has 42 years already working for us. And it's quite intense. We have about roughly 2,500 bottles which we can produce per hour. This sounds maybe like a lot in comparison to if you look like a brewery, where you have up to 60,000 bottles per hour, then you can't see the bottles. They are just, you don't see the individual bottle. This is different here. It's a little bit calm, and we always say we know each bottle which is going out of here.
By ignoring business advisors who told him to focus on just half a dozen products, Peter's juices have caught the attention of many gourmet chefs, who are helping to ensure that mouth-to-mouth propaganda continues to spread far and wide. Nick Martin, DW, Hammondkeln, Germany.
It was Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk tank. An old man said to me, won't see another one. And then he sang a song, the rare old mountain tune. I turned my face away and dreamed about you.
For our last report in this Christmas show, we turn to the bad Santas out there. All over the world, there are tens of thousands of them who congregate as part of the SantaCon movement and celebrate every year on various dates during the holiday season. Lena Nozizwe reports from Los Angeles that these Santas may not fit everyone's notion of Father Christmas.
It's a challenge to get the Santa cosplayers who have gathered in Santa Monica to fully identify themselves
or to identify themselves at all.
My name is Kaya Santa.
How do you want to be identified? Your name?
Santa.
Santa, but Santa John, Santa Stu.
Santa Claus.
Thank you.
It's kind of like what happens in SantaCon stays in SantaCon, a mostly red, often racy, patently raucous global event that started in San Francisco more than 20 years ago, based on an inspiration of Danish merry pranksters who wanted to make a political statement in their home country. I'll have another drink is the statement you are most likely to hear these days from Seattle to Shanghai and from Miami to Munich. In all, more than 380 cities in more than 50 countries take part in the event, which is basically a way to tie one on with hundreds of other fully dressed Santas, reindeers, and elves.
Why do I come?
Year after year.
To join the red tie, to be merry and jolly and drunk. Yes, yes.
LA SantaCon is the fifth one for Santa Kaya. While it has already become a sauced and saucy holiday tradition for some, there are plenty of first-timers among the hundreds of Kris Kringles who gathered in Los Angeles. But a minority of SantaCon Santas at celebrations around the U.S. have gone beyond naughty, and their sleighs have veered into illegal territory. Over the years, there have been multiple arrests, probably with New York's events getting the most publicity and the biggest turnouts. Unsanta-like behavior throughout America has included disorderly conduct, public intoxication, and violations of open container laws.
It's the best time of the year. You can get drunk and pretend like you all still believe in Santa Claus.
That's who we'll call Santa C back in Los Angeles, who stands on a busy public street holding on to an open beer can nestled in a brown paper bag, but she won't admit it, even though she seems more lit than a Christmas tree.
No, I don't. I have a brown bag.
The organizers of the worldwide event do provide guidelines, which include don't get drunk, don't make children cry, and don't mess with security.
Tell me where we're going.
Rusty's.
We're trying to go to Rusty's, but we're just...
In LA, coordinators tweeted the path for the Red Revelers in real time from bar to bar, with a couple of strip clubs thrown in, along with exhortations to be nice. That falls in line with comments from Santa Sarah, a veteran of SantaCons around the United States. From her vantage point, this year's L.A. SantaCon was chill. And that does not just refer to the weather.
Here, everybody's like...
It's an older
yeah, no, it's a calmer version.
And Santa Brandon, who is wearing a white dreadlocked wig under his red Santa hat, says there's much more to SantaCon than bros over... Ho, ho, ho's. He says his reason for taking part is downright old-fashioned.
Just for the spirit of Christmas, just to have fun. You know, a lot of people have been waving, having fun, wanting to take pictures. They've been enjoying it, spreading cheer.
Old-fashioned with a twist.
This Santa won't go to a strip club, but he might strip.
Look out.
Look out, world.
A Santa with more of an affinity with the stripper pole than the North Pole? A Santa more concerned about making it rain than snow, a sure sign that SantaCon has come to town.
Thanks there to Lena Nozizwe, bringing us to the end of this week's WorldLink. We hope you enjoyed the show, and will join us again next week for more personal stories around the globe. You can always find the program or any individual reports at dw.com/WorldLink, SoundCloud, or iTunes. And if you have any feedback, please don't hesitate to drop us a line at worldlink@dw.com. We always love to hear from you. The show was produced by me, Gabriel Borud. Our sound engineer was Erhard Berger. WorldLink was brought to you by DW in Bonn, Germany.